This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 6th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 148, with me, Robert Bounds, and Aisha Spears. On today's show, we'll be talking to Hannah Poole about beauty. Is it in the eye of the beholder? And if so, why does France see things so differently?
We'll also be talking to Shelby Coffey, former editor of the Los Angeles Times and president of CNN Business News, about how he covered the LA riots 20 years ago. And we'll be meeting author Philip Dells Broughton, whose new book perfects the art of the sell. We're sold already.
All that, plus some great music, right here on the Monocle Weekly. The dynamic duo, it's the gruesome twosome. Maybe it's the toothsome twosome.
I've got all my teeth, thank you very much.
Toothsome means just good.
It
means good looking and feisty and
certainly
fun.
That.
That's what we are.
I know, it's a very different Monocle Weekly than I've ever been on before. It's just you and me.
I know, we're in a big studio. Here we are, I'm Studio One at Midori House, and it's just the two of us. And also, it's not just the two of us. There's a good reason why it's only the two of us, because it's an hour-long show. We've gone back to the classic format.
I like that. Brief on a Sunday.
I'm holding the script here, and I only need one hand to pick it up. What a relief!
That's right.
You're over from New York. You've been a busy girl since you've been here. We normally sort of say, "How was your week?" in a slightly self-referential way. But I can ask you, "How's your week?" 'Cause I don't really know, because I've hardly seen you. You've been sort of leaving the office. You've been on the morning shift. You've been doing the Globalist. Busy girl.
I haven't really seen myself. I have been doing the Globalist. It was great. I was with Hugo at the beginning of the week, and then Christian Yeo, and it was a great week of the Globalist. But being on the Atlantic time. Eastern Seaboard time was quite an odd one for the very early morning starts here.
I like
in
how you talk. I like your phraseology. It sounds like you're used to normally directing ships or something.
It's shipping news.
I was going to say.
And this is not the Monocle Weekly. It's, in fact, Monocle's shipping news.
Dogger, Fisher, German bite. I think the show sounds like a good one. It's lean, it's mean. Mm-hmm. It's the two of us. This is going to be okay.
Yep.
Shelby Coffey, he's the man that was the editor of the LA Times 20 years ago during the Rodney King riots. I think he's going to be an interesting guest.
There's been a lot of coverage in the States, about the 20-year anniversary, but I think if we were going to speak to anyone, speaking to him is pretty key, seeing as he was covering it there and then.
And you wrote this great thing, I think it was on the LA Times, but I think it's in the form of a blog, or maybe it's in the form of a long essay about sort of that first night of the riot. So hopefully we'll be kind of getting a bit of the spirit of that.
And it's weird because it is one of the first kind of major civil uprisings that you can now still see in YouTube. So it's so easy for those of us who weren't around in LA 20 years ago to be able just to go, okay, what's he talking about? Oh, yeah, and then just click on a link, which really, it's an odd way of digesting that kind of news.
It is, isn't it? You almost still have faith in things when you feel like something that hasn't been taken down. Because it's an amazing touch paper to light every time someone clicks on that. I don't know how many clicks. We can find that out later, but it's a funny thing. And also, on that slight tip, Hannah Poole is coming in a minute. In fact, I think I can see her out in the green room. She's coming in to talk about Miss Black France and the surrounding politics around Miss Black France as opposed to just Miss France.
The quite boldly titled Miss Black France, which is very key today, seeing it's the French election today, and the issue of race and nationality is constantly up for debate in France, it seems.
And it's the capital of fashion. So why has it got such a strange attitude to people with all sorts of different coloured skin?
Who knows?
Why should it make a difference?
We're going to find out.
Why don't we find out? Also, our last guest is Philip Dells Broughton. I've tried to pick a witty song to go in the middle of that interview.
I'm excited.
Watch out for that, kids. Anyway, up next, we will have Hannah Poole in to talk about Miss Black France and about the sort of Parisian attitude to beauty after this. France is a country we often associate with fashion, flamboyance and above all, beauty. But a recent celebration of just that has divided opinion in Paris after Mbatio Beye, a 21-year-old Senegalese student, was crowned the first ever Miss Black France last week. The contest organisers say the traditional Miss France is not representative of modern French society, while others think that separate competition goes against the very fabric of French society, founded on libertarian, secular ideals. Joining us in the studio now is Eritrean-born journalist and author Hannah Poole, whose book, My Father's Daughter, tackles issues of race and identity in the UK. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
That was quite a wordy introduction, wasn't it?
It was. Nevertheless. It was a life and an introduction at the same time.
It was. And in 1978,
exactly.
Hannah Poole. But this is a big thing. It's been all over. I mean, it's been second only to the French election, but it's also kind of to do with the French election. It's an issue, isn't it, in French politics? And it's not just a gender issue, but it's a sort of civil rights issue. How's it sort of played out? I mean, how do you see it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's central to what France is talking about at the moment. Race is a very big part of the election and a very big part of French culture in general. And you have to remember that while, you know, France is all of those things that you said at the beginning, it's very different to how race has played out in the UK, actually, given how close we are in a lot of other ways. And I think this story has really brought out quite a divisive nature within French society.
And I always wondered the difference between the UK and France, or maybe Paris and London. Seems to be a difference between a multicultural society and a multiracial society.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the classic example is the banlieue, and the fact that in France, the most, not all, but a majority of the black population are on the outside, in the suburbs. But the French suburbs aren't like the London suburbs, which is the kind of aspirational side. Whereas in London, obviously, part of the beauty of London is the diversity and the fact that everybody is sort of cheek by jowl.
And why is, I mean, Miss France historically, have there not been many black participants? Why was there the need to create a Miss Black France?
That's right. So although I think a couple of years ago there was a biracial French woman won, Miss France, but I think in general the competition is considered to be very monocultural, if you say, and, you know, very white. It's not called Miss White France, but I think a lot of people feel that it probably is.
It's interesting when you think about, it's a bit of a tenuous stretch, but you're a journalist, and to think about this within the world of fashion and culture, a couple of years ago Vogue Italia did this amazing black issue. I think it was the first Vogue to do that, and it sold out, and it was widely kind of praised as being this important part of black culture and black society. And Italy has similar issues with immigration and racial tension. Do you think there's any hope for France in that way?
I think, yeah. Italy and France, certainly in the fashion world, for example, are considered to be incredibly conservative. Mm. You know, models struggle really hard. Models of colour struggle really hard in Paris and Milan, in a way that they just don't struggle in London, and they certainly don't struggle so much in New York. Mm-hmm. That's probably, if you were going to sort of grade them, New York is the most diverse, then it would probably be London. Or maybe not. I don't know. London is, you know, pretty good, actually. But then Paris and Milan for black models is just a nightmare.
When you say that, do you mean the way people are treated or getting a job? Or both?
Both. Yeah. Getting a job, full stop, is very difficult. Whether it's, you know, certainly getting catwalk stuff is very, very difficult for models of colour at both Milan and Paris. And getting signed up by major agents, getting taken on for advertising campaigns, which is where the money is.
Yeah.
And that's really, for me, that's what all of these things are about. About actually both money and, I suppose, representation. And you're talking about the Vogue Italia Black, which was a huge, Vogue Italia's Black issue, which was huge and fabulous in many ways, but not unproblematic.
Right.
And it was actually only, I think it was in 2009, French Vogue did a 16-page shoot with Lara Stone, the Dutch model, mm-hmm. and they blacked her up.
Do you remember that?
They kind of are as well.
Yeah.
And they had her decked out in this kind of feathers mm-hmm. and all this weird exotic kind of stuff that was meant to kind of portray exoticism. So again, that shows you how perhaps behind they are in terms of thinking about race and fashion and beauty.
Mm-hmm. Is that fashion kind of having its own rules, or do you think fashion kind of makes the rules for how people, you know, how it is a sort of trickle down effect? If you see someone on the front cover of a magazine, or you don't see a certain face on the front cover of a magazine, It changes the way you think about things.
Absolutely. These things, you can say it's fashion and fashion doesn't matter, but fashion matters hugely. We're all affected by it. You don't have to be, you don't have to be reading Vogue all the time to be affected by fashion. And it's about turning on the TV and seeing yourself represented. It's about turning on, whether it's MTV or whether it's kind of high fashion, seeing that a certain kind of ideal is the only kind of ideal when you're talking about what's beautiful.
The interesting thing in this particular one is that demonstrators have been calling for a Miss White France, which really does. The idea of separating, I mean, it's just so incredibly backwards. It reminded me when we were looking at this story of what Morgan Freeman was trying to do in the Deep South in Mississippi with the prom. So obviously you have some very segregated towns still in Mississippi, and there's the white prom, there's the black prom. Mm-hmm. And the kids wanted a black prom because otherwise they couldn't really go to the white prom. Yeah. And in some sense, to separate them, have a Miss White France, it's just completely against the point, really.
It is, and I think it's almost against the point of this competition, because actually this is actually about inclusion. Although obviously it's called Miss Black France, it's in response to the fact that Miss France is generically a kind of a very white competition. They don't have to call it that. You don't have to call Vogue White Vogue. It just, they just don't have many black women in it.
Yeah.
And so I don't. So to me, the response to that, I think, is a bit ridiculous, and it's not looking at the whole context for having it.
Now, how did it actually work? So how far did they go with, you know, kind of the black issue within the competition? Was it just the girls being able to participate? Were all the judges black? Was there white support of it?
Good question.
How many white people were involved in Miss Black France?
I very much doubt it was an all black event,
right.
because it was France, simply because it's Europe. You know, I'm sure that there were white people were allowed to take part. I'm sure it was fine.
But surely the important thing would be,
I don't know, maybe they were serving coffee in the canteen. I don't know.
You know, what would be really progressive would be for Miss Black France to set the example that Miss France should set, and just be like, have all, mix it all up, just rather than having just anyone.
Again, I'm sure it was probably very carefully worded. I mean, the title Miss Black France is obviously not that carefully worded, and it's fairly, you know, you might be. Well, it's interesting. I wonder if people who read that and thought, I was gonna enter, and now I can't.
Right.
I don't know. You know, it wasn't. It's very. It, the use of the word black is interesting as well, rather than African or whatever. And that's another thing I think that's interesting. I think for Europe, as opposed to, say, America. In America, they have African-American, and I don't think there would be an issue with something like this there. There is obviously the history of segregation, but actually, from segregation, you had, you know, amazing black churches, amazing black universities, amazing black law firms. So in some ways, the black community, the African-American community, made some kind of really important movements as a result of being segregated.
We're going to stop it there. We're going to cut our chat with Hannah in half. We're going to break for a song. This is from Norrin Jones' new album. It came out last week. The album's called Little Broken Hearts. The song is called Say Goodbye. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly, where you heard Say Goodbye, which is new from Norah Jones. I think that track, if not the whole album, is produced by Danger Mouse. You could hear that a bit, couldn't you?
You could hear that a little bit.
Some knob twiddling there.
You could hear the afro.
And we are with Hannah Poole, and we're talking about Miss Black France and whether or not, what on earth that means. Hannah, we've got a quote. We've got some briefing notes. Let's not pretend we do this without briefing notes. We've got some briefing notes in there. Well, let's not pretend I can remember this quote verbatim without reading it, okay? And it says this. This is from Patrick Lewes, who's the former director of the French Representative Council of Black Associations. And he said to Le Monde, this contest is detrimental to the values of French society. These girls need to feel French, not black, in French society. And we were talking while that song was playing about France being a place which has always tried to assimilate people from its former colonies and all the rest of it. This is not clearly the successful way to do it. But I wondered, you know, as a journalist, how exotic black still seems. Whether it can ever be normal, it's still kind of seen as exotic.
In the West, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's still seen as other. It's still seen as a point of difference, which is understandable to a degree, because if you're in a Western society, you are in a majority white society. That's not the issue, really. But the issue is about kind of, for me, it's about proportionality and representation and versus marginality, Redesine being marginalised. And I think that's what this competition is in response to, rather than a generic idea that, you know, we want to be separate. I think you can be both French and black and still take part in Miss Black France. I think the way for black women in France and, you know, across Europe to feel part of where they are or to feel valued is more to do about the society that they're in. These things don't happen in a vacuum, is what I'm trying to say.
I mean,
and they wouldn't happen in lots of other countries, we're also saying.
Yeah.
You know, certain countries have a problem.
Although,
with it. Certain countries don't know when they're doing something that's clearly mental.
I mean, in America,
it's true, right?
It's true. Yeah. I think France and Italy have really interesting and comparable, because they both have.
Oh, you're using interesting in inverted commas. The size of this building, Hannah Poole.
I'm trying to not get lots of kind of French and Italians on my case. But compared to the UK, for example, they have similar colonial pasts. And so what's interesting is that there, and as we were saying earlier on, France is very much about assimilating, and everybody is French first and everything else must come later, mm-hmm. whether that's religion or whether that's another place of origin. And so that's really interesting compared to, say, the UK, where assimilating versus integrating and all that sort of that whole thing is fascinating.
If you look at, I mean, I'm sure if in the US there is, a Miss half Hawaiian competition, there'll be a Miss, a Miss Korean competition. All of these races in the US probably will be represented. It's the fact that this in France is such a big deal and that it's still such an other that it has to be a statement against it. And, you know, the real solution surely should be that the Miss France competition should have a committee in it which makes sure that there's some sort of easy access.
Absolutely. Or you just, you know, it's not even about special treatment, actually. It's not about favours. It's about proportionality. It's making sure that the judges are aware, making sure that the judges don't automatically, you know, the judges are going to be, you know, experiencing exactly the same media, if you like, and representations of beauty as everybody else. So when they are looking for what represents beauty in, you know, the French ideal, they obviously have a picture in their minds that doesn't include the darker skin.
It's an interesting thing, talking about in the US there might be a Miss Half Hawaiian, a Miss Korean, as Aisha joked. But there's a weird thing of sort of celebrating your community and it being a quite fine thing to do. And a difference, there seems to somehow be a difference in this. This is clearly something which is done in opposition to something else or to make a statement about the colour blindness of something else, right? There are two different things. You can celebrate your community and not be exclusive to other people, presumably.
Yeah, but again, I don't have that much of a problem with it. I don't think that they're being, I mean, obviously the title is Miss Black France, but I think it's actually about making the people who feel left out by the regular Miss France competition feel included, rather than about excluding all the white women who would have entered, because, you know, there are lots of competitions they can enter and they are much more likely to win them. So I think this is much more about feeding the desire, if you like, of the other women in France who are not being represented in any way, you know, sort of as the beauty ideal, rather than about excluding the others.
Has there been much response from the official Miss France competition?
I don't know. It would be interesting to see what happens next year. Mm. It would be interesting to see who the judges are in general. And who applies in general. And that process anyway is, I mean, again, the whole idea of Miss World and Miss France and all of that is something that I think, you know, I'm more likely to be kind of protesting against the misogyny of that in general. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think these competitions, perhaps as we get more modern, they are highlighted, you know, their deficiencies are highlighted. And this is a really good example of how.
That's like we should have an Eastern European Song Contest.
Yeah,
or the Eastern European Song Contest, the Western European, the old European Song Contest.
You don't need to call
contest.
It that, exactly.
Exactly, yeah. There you go. Well, Hannah Poole, thank you so much for coming in to the studio. Hannah Poole, author of My Father's Daughter. Thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hannah Poole was very good, wasn't she?
She was lovely. I think she made a very good point, which is that there's no Miss, you don't call it Miss White France. And the black issue, any sort of colour issue is always going to be a big one. The white issue in South Africa, it depends on what context you're discussing it, surely.
I kind of want to fast forward to the end of the day to know what the results of the French election are. I've been genuinely excited by this one.
I think do we find out tomorrow morning?
It should be tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They'll be globalisting it up to the nines, won't they, possibly? They'll still be reading polls at that time in the morning. I'm not quite sure.
How quick are the French?
Well, that starts at sort of 7 a.m. French time, doesn't it, that show? So we'll see. How quick are the French?
How quick are the French,
Discuss?
I know. How quick are they?
I think it's one of those things. I wonder whether it's one of those things which is a slow seepage of results or whether it's presidential. Presumably it's a quicker thing.
Who's your money on?
My money's on Sarkozy, actually.
Is it?
I don't think he'll lose it. I just can't see him losing it.
I think it's on Hollande.
I mean, I know it's meant to be, but I don't know, I can't see him.
We'll see, we'll check in with the globalists.
In the end, I think people probably would kind of sort of think, even if they're not, they'll probably think they're voting with their pockets by going with Sarkozy.
I'm just glad it's not Le Pen. I'm glad she's not even in the running anymore.
Well, indeed.
Last week we lost Le Pen and Newt Gingrich.
I can't think of a song that can take us from Marine Le Pen into...
Let's pretend I didn't just mention that word.
All right. We're going to actually go to Copenhagen. This is a new band called, well, not a new band, but it's a new record from a guy who called Noya Makijani. Who knows? Well, he's Danish, but he might... I don't know where his surname comes from. It's called... Anyway, he calls himself Choir of Young Believers. They've got a new album out called Rhine Gold, and this song from it is Chilled, and it's called Sedated.
That was rather nice. That was the Choir of Young Believers. In a moment, we'll be going across the Atlantic to speak to Shelby Coffey about the LA riots. Twenty years ago, Los Angeles was caught in some of the worst riots ever seen in the US, as racial tensions and distrust of the police overspilled into anarchy. Shelby Coffey III was editor of the LA Times during that era, and his skillful interpretation of complex issues won him the National Press Foundation's Editor of the Year Award in 1995, as well as numerous Pulitzers awarded to the paper's staff. As last year's London riots proved, these stories erupt with little warning in some of the world's most developed cities. To tell us how to handle news in a crisis, Shelby Coffey joins us on the line from Washington. Shelby, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Thank you very much for taking time.
I'm honoured. Thank you.
20 years on, what are your most kind of memorable moments from that time?
Starting the afternoon before the announcement of the verdicts about the beating trial of Rodney King, who was a black motorist who had been caught going quite a fast rate of speed and then had been apprehended and was famously beaten on a videotape. We knew that there might be a considerable amount of outrage if the verdict was innocent. So the key thing for us was to have a plan and deploy. Now, you all know newsrooms, and we tend to run on caffeine and competition and not a great deal of forward planning. But in this case, we did have it, and we did decide to deploy. At first, in the afternoon, there was a usual sort of 200 or so protesters down around City Hall and the Parker Center, which is the main police building in the center of Los Angeles, very near the Los Angeles Times. As the afternoon went on, some of the demonstrations grew. By nighttime, that had turned into a much angrier mob, and a great deal of fires were set, rocks were thrown. The Los Angeles Times, which is a large fortress on Spring Street, unfortunately had a set of road construction going on beside it, which made for handy asphalt rocks to be pulled out of it and thrown.
And some of these were thrown straight into the LA Times office, weren't they? Into your office. I mean, it was pummeled with stuff, right?
Yes, indeed. I still have rocks from that time.
Mementos.
And I remember the windows breaking.
Shelby, I wonder whether we could go back and talk about the sort of 20th anniversary, if you want a better word, of the LA riots. What was happening? What was happening to you that night? I know you drove through town. Obviously, the LA Times office was kind of bombarded with rocks and stuff. You were right in the thick of it. What was on the radio? What was the smell in the air? What were the noises? What could you hear and see around you as you went from the LA Times office back home that night? Be nice to know, kind of get a flavor of the atmosphere that night.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. As I mentioned, the rioters were throwing rocks and had broken out all the windows on our bottom floor. At one point, one of our bravest news administrators offered to go down with me because we heard looters were there. I went down, and a looter, in fact, was coming in, and I grabbed some scissors and yelled at him, "Get out." Very luckily for me, he did. So my wife, who's an emergency room doctor, later told me, "You should go back upstairs." Because I had walked around among the rioters. What was interesting to me and probably should be emphasized is the crowd in the downtown riots, which were where much of it began, was a multi-hued crowd. And I think this had to do with the original demonstration, which I would say was our usual crowd of, broadly speaking, anti-authoritarian demonstrators who were ready to come out at any problem. It grew in size. There was almost a sense of enjoyment, delight at breaking the windows, throwing the rocks.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's the way that crowds work, isn't it? That it's this addictive kind of carnival atmosphere that you wrote about as well.
carnival is exactly the right word. It didn't always stay that way. There were certainly, in other parts of the city, there were targeted burnings of especially Korean shopkeepers' places, and there were vicious things going on. It was a Shakespearean range. Finally, at 2 o'clock, I drove through Chinatown. I remember very clearly the fires all over Los Angeles. I lived above the Rose Bowl, and so you saw the Los Angeles basin as a whole, and it looked rather like the pictures you might see of Baghdad during the bombardments from a distance. I did play, there was a rather famous album at the time called Straight Outta Compton, which is a very raw gangster.
Is the editor of the LA Times allowed to play NWA out of his car window during that period?
Well, I was playing it loud. I had a Corvette. These were my California years. My wife had given it to me. And so I pulled in the driveway, and I even at this late date, I hasten to say, I was playing it just to not fall asleep, not as an advocate. And I went to the door to go in, and my son, bless him, had a baseball bat there. He was 18, and he was defending his mother, because it's a very bad sign to hear Dr. Dre and Ice Cube and Eazy-E playing 2:30 in the morning in the driveway while the city's burning. Luckily, he didn't brain me, but I sometimes say in talks that I could have become a small form of journalistic immortality by saying LA Times editor killed on own front porch for playing loud gangster rap music
by own son.
Well, we're overlooking that. Yeah. I think I might have been a low-ranking Jeopardy question.
And it'd be interesting. I wonder what your son would make of it now, 20 years later. I mean, with social media, maybe he's got an iPhone or a BlackBerry. I mean, you know, these are things that sort of fused the London riots together. How different could it have been if that happened today, and how much quicker?
It's so interesting you bring that up. I'm vice chairman of the museum here in Washington. I invite you and all Monocle people and listeners to come by the museum. We just opened our new Hewlett-Packard New Media Gallery because we were designed 9 years ago, before Twitter was even a gleam in BizStone's eye, and Facebook was still more or less a dating service for Mark Zuckerberg, the movie, the social media is right. And I think it would have changed things drastically at the very least, on a human-to-human level. My son had been out at a Lou Reed concert at the Greek Theater and had barely gotten home. We would have been able to communicate much more easily. There would have been probably much quicker response. And, of course, as famously in the London riots, the pictures very easily taken of the perpetrators, which would be a way of tracking them down.
Shelby Coffey III, thank you so much for telling us about your time as editor of the LA Times 20 years ago and those sort of seminal moments of the LA riots. We're going to take a cue from you now, and we're going to play Express Yourself by NWA.
I'm expressing with my full capabilities, and now I'm living in correctional facilities, because some don't agree with how I do this. I get straight and meditate like a Buddhist. I'm dropping flavor, my behavior is hereditary.
Never would have thought I'd heard NWA on the Monocle Weekly, but it is a Sunday. Philip Dales-Broughton talking sales coming up next.
Philip Dales-Broughton is an author and journalist whose new book, The Art of the Sale, aims to shine a light on the importance of personality in business success. He says that sales are the greatest laboratory there is for studying human nature. And he joins us now. Philip, all welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Now, when the sale is made, when you see people selling themselves, selling their wares out of a suitcase door to door, however it might be, that's an old-fashioned image, I kind of like that, though. Is this when you see? Is this when you see the civility in people, or the animal beneath the civility?
I think that's what's so interesting about it. I think it, you see both. And I think, you know, if you look back over 100 years of business, the great tendency has been towards sort of dehumanizing. Where it started with, you know, industrialization of manufacturing, and now you see it in sort of technology and outsourcing. Essentially, humans being ever more removed from the process of business. Mm-hmm. And what really interested me about selling was whatever you do, you can't remove the ghost of the machine that is the kind of eyeball to eyeball contact between two human beings. One decides to buy, one decides to sell. Obviously, it's changing enormously with, you know, LinkedIn, Facebook. You know, you can prospect very differently. You can find people to sell to. But ultimately, what it comes down to is two people looking themselves in the eye and deciding what to do about each other. And, you know, I describe the Apple stores, you know, everyone knows Apple, but, you know, it's really interesting that there you have the most revered name in technology. And when they went retail, they went aggressively retail in the middle of cities, not out in business parks. And they staffed their stores with people who are passionate about photography and music, all these things, not real salespeople. They went to a very old fashioned retail sales strategy with what we consider the most, you know, advanced technology products in most of our lives.
So it's the return of the sale in modern sort of merchandising, modern retail.
Yeah, you know, you see companies like J. Crew, for example, has been this sort of great renaissance of the clothing store. You know, for a while there, it seemed everything was going the sort of Gap direction. You know, with just piles and piles of clothes, and you went, there was no one really there, and you sort of check yourself out almost. But now you're seeing brands return to this kind of high touch retail strategy. Whether it's something that's, you know, can be seen across the board at a real scale, I don't know. Whether it's just a kind of niche thing for those companies that can afford it and the kind of high-end consumers, I don't know, but often you see these companies, they return to the notion that the salesman, whether it's the bespoke tailor or the cobbler or whatever it is, has real value today still.
I had a meeting earlier on in the week with Alex Calderwood from the Ace Hotels, and he was talking to me about a new technology that actually is an app from Apple that allows people just to scan on their iPhone, I assume, a barcode. What they go into a shop, they scan it, they leave, and it gets delivered to them, I think. And so even within the Apple model, which is this wonderfully personal, I mean, it's a great retail experience. You can go in there and you can chat to people, and it's very easy to buy face-to-face. How do you apply this idea that sales is still such a personal relationship if someone can go in there but still choose to use an app and not talk to a single human being? Where does that leave sales?
Well, it's maddening. So, you know, a good example is the bookstore business, right? You know, everyone loves a bookstore, but then people go in, look at books, and then go back home and buy an Amazon. Yeah. And it destroys booksellers. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can say to your blue in the face, you know, but go and buy in a bookstore, but if it's 25-30% cheaper on Amazon, people go. I think that's a huge conundrum. I can't answer that one. But what you do see is that you know, a great retail experience is enormous. Ace Hotel is a good example. You know, the one in New York that I've been to several times, you know, they've sort of almost revived the idea of the hotel lobby. Mm-hmm. Right. So for a while, the hotel lobby was a sort of, you know, nightclub disco, you know, cocktail lounge. And Ace Hotel has turned it into kind of an all-day coffee bar, you know, MacBook kind of experience, mm-hmm. Which again is very high touch, very personal, very intimate, and yet, you know, the people who stay there are people whose jobs are at the kind of forefront of technology. So you see these things going back and forth. And in the book, you know, I range from a Moroccan souk is where I start, and I end at Salesforce.com in San Francisco, which is, you know, sells sales software. And, you know, again, you can't kick human beings out of this experience. Now, their role sort of shrinks and grows and shrinks and grows, but they're always sort of there, and they're very persistent. And the skills that the best salespeople have, even today, we talk about Apple, everyone seems to talk about Apple. Jobs was a great salesman, but, you know, look at Cisco, John Chambers, the CEO, that great salesman. You could say that the role of the CEO today, with highly dispersed workforces all over the world, great outsourcing, two jobs. One is being a chief salesman for the company, and the second is, you know, hiring. And everything else is sort of done by other people. The job of the CEO is really a number one thing, is sell the company.
And how do you differentiate between these kind of different qualities of sales? It's quite a glamorous one to be Steve Jobs, you know, to have been Steve Jobs up there on a stage selling, basically PRing your product to millions of viewers. But then you can't help but, you know, the Willy Lomans, the death of a salesman, the kind of the suitcase salesman, yeah, going door to door. It's not a glamorous one. How important is selling, the idea of selling?
Well, it's hugely important. So, you know, you start with these two extreme examples. You're just pointing them out. So on the one hand, you have Glengarry, Glen Ross, Willy Loman. You know, sales is essentially the sort of job that makes you a capitalist cog more than any other. Your whole life, you sacrifice your personality, your friendships, everything is about, everything becomes commercialized and sort of economic. And then on the other, and you have these sort of very cheesy extremes, the sort of Donald Trump, the guy in the shiny suit that's telling you to be a certain way.
I don't know what you mean.
And I think both of those are really off-putting for most people. And then, but the truth of the matter is that we all have to sell one way or another. As I say, you know, whether you're selling to your, you know, family, your partner, your work, whatever you're doing, you're selling. So we don't really have a choice but to sell. So one has to find a way to get comfortable with it. And it doesn't need to be Willy Loman. Now, why sales is so interesting, why I wrote about it, is because, you know, I went to Harvard Business School and they don't teach it. It seemed to me an area of business that, you know, if you're not in business, the one thing you see most visibly of business is the salespeople. Mm-hmm. And that's why playwrights write about sales, but they don't write about accountants. They rarely write about lawyers. They do write about lawyers. But salespeople are often the great icons, you know, for good or ill, in sort of cultural portrayals of business, because that's who we see if you're not there. And they're the sort of flesh and blood, and they're dealing with these highly personal issues that, again, one can understand even if one's not in business. You know, to what extent do you mix personal and professional friendships? What masks do you put on to get what you want? What is your relationship to truth and lies? What do you do to make a buck? You know, those are the kind of difficult ones. And then there are some very more positive ones, is how do you create a perception of value around products in other people's minds? You know, and there are forms that, you know, you listen hard to the customer, but, you know, I have a chapter in my book about art dealers. You know, I try to make
this
the point.
Is a really, yeah, yeah. I was going to ask you this, this about week. This as well. This is a really interesting thing between knowing your subject, being an expert on your subject, and being a damn good salesman, and the environment in which you sell, and all the rest of it.
Yeah, but, you know, also with art, you know, I say that culture doesn't happen without great salesmen. So you think that it's just the work of artists, but, you know, they're just daubs and shapes until people get in there and start creating some hype and excitement and conveying the value to collectors and all the other people.
And journalism on the subject is a type of sales as well, of course.
Exactly. There's journalism about art, but, you know, there's also, you know, we think of great film producers, you know, the Harvey Weinsteins of this world, you know, again, a man with a very mixed reputation, as sort of, you know, a bully and, you know, whatever else he may be. But, you know, he gives the world amazing movies year after year after year that no one else could. It takes a certain type to do these rather remarkable things.
We're going to break, Philip, for a song now. I wanted to pick something that sounded kind of vaguely on trend for this. So this is Warrior in Woolworths, right back from, I think, 1978, by the X-Ray Specs. Why on earth are we playing Warrior in Woolworths by X-Ray Specs on the Monocle Weekly? Because we're speaking to Philip Dales Bruton, author of the new book, The Art of the Sale. Philip, we were talking before you started about art dealers and the sort of different types of sort of salesmen there are. You also said that you wonder whether it could be taught. Can it be taught? Is it something innate? Is it something as innate as being an artist?
So I say in the book there are two or three fundamental human traits that you really need to be a good salesman. They are sort of unteachable after the age of about 18 or 19. And they are sort of, you know, a sense of optimism, being resilient, tenacious. And these tend to be traits that are hardened into you in your youth, your childhood, your kind of experiences early. Now, you can fix those in people, but it's enormously expensive and time-consuming to do so in adulthood. So most companies can't be bothered.
To bring them out, to draw out the salesmanship.
These traits, the optimism, the resilience, the tenacity, if people are kind of socially phobic, if they suffer from all these things, it's you can do it, you know, through therapy, through all kinds of things. But it's, you know, most companies don't have the time. But if you have those three things, then you can teach all kinds of other things like closing, product knowledge, understanding the customer, matching your sales process to their buying process. All these things can be taught. You know, and again, I'd say those things of optimism, tenacity, resilience, you know, what's interesting, what's not there is, you know, being 6'2" or having a cheesy smile. Yeah. You know, you can get these qualities in all kinds of very, very different people who look very different, who seem very different. And again, you know, what I would say is one of these phrases you always hear about selling is you've got to be passionate about your product. And I think that's nonsense. What I think you have to be really into is a sort of system of selling. So some people are wonderful seducers and one-off, you know, you hear this again and again from salespeople. They love to turn a no into a yes. Yeah. And they like to do it 10 times a day. And they do it with the person they sell, you know, who sells them a coffee in the morning. They
try. I presume it's an addictive thing. It's something that it works sort of on a micro and a macro level.
And it's sort of part sexual. I mean, you know, the most obvious is the great sort of serial seducer. That's the most visible, easiest way to understand that. But then there are other people, you know, who love selling art, for example, because they love the art world, right? So they love the friendships that it brings them. They love they love going to the Biennale. They love the artist. They love that whole thing. And then they're salesmen because they work in a particular context. You know, whether you're, you know, a literary agent or, you know, someone who sells design products, you sell well in that environment because it's an environment you're very comfortable with. you like the people, you trust them, you enjoy their company, you're willing to pick up the phone to them several times a week and have a discussion, take them out for lunch, and you will end up selling well in that environment. But that's a very different concept of what, you know, what we think of as a great salesman.
You mentioned earlier that the, you know, the art of the sale is also used within, you know, human interaction. It has absolutely nothing to do with exchange of currency or good, but within relationships, within marriages. How do you see that? I mean, going a little bit more into psychology, which you were talking about, those three tenets of what makes a good salesperson. Where do you, is there a sense that you lose a genuine feeling? If you're even in a relationship, can you be selling whilst also being true? Is there a toss up there?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be a tension. But I think, you know, take it out of the business world and put it into exactly that, into, you know, one's personal life, one's, you know, most intimate relationships. Everyone knows what that feels like. Right, you know, we all crave transparent, beautifully honest relationships, but then there are always times that everyone is slightly pulling the wool over each other's eyes, you know, whether it's with your parents, your lover, your husband, whatever it is. And that's recognizable to everyone, that feeling. And I don't think sales is any different. Sometimes you need to do certain things to get what you want. Now, people will do better or worse things. And I think it's that quite, you know, everyone will have their own standard for that. So, you know, one doesn't want to be too moralistic about this. Mm-hmm. But that willingness to be different people in different audiences, I think we're all very, very familiar with. And then you take that and then you apply it to the business world. And, you know, I talk at the end of my book about Nelson Mandela, as, you know, and the Dalai Lama as two people we don't think of as salespeople. But the Dalai Lama, when he came out of Tibet in the, you know, in the 50s...
They both had books out.
But the Dalai Lama, when he came out of Tibet in the 50s, was, you know, he was like this highly scholarly monk who spoke the sort of Himalayan equivalent of Latin, you know, impenetrable to people. And the Dalai Lama we see today, this kind of grinning guru of happiness, you know, part of the time, but, you know, behind the scenes, he could be a very sort of acid-tongued politician. You know, that's a creation, but he created it for the good of his, you know, the people of Tibet and, you know, what he thought was right. Nelson Mandela, again, you know, went into prison as a sort of, you know, an apostle of violent resistance. And while in prison, twigged that the whites knew the gig was up. And there was an opportunity for him to become the bridge to a kind of post-apartheid South Africa. He started, you know, learning about rugby's Africana poetry and made himself a much more acceptable figure. Now, if someone sold us a car that way, we'd feel a little cheated. Mm. But with Mandela, we feel, you know, ends justify the means. You know, he did what was necessary to achieve a very, very noble end. And I think, again, you know, that's important to think of when you think about selling. It's not just all about tricks and means. It's about ends and what's needed to persuade people.
Well, we can't leave this conversation, Philip, without talking about the ultimate salespeople. We mentioned Dalai Lama and Nelson Mandela, but there's an election today in Paris, in France, and of course in November in the US. Do you see politicians as being the kind of people that would knock down the guy that's serving them a cappuccino in the morning for 10 cents? Or do you see them as selling art and being passionate and loving the art world? Which ones are they? Are they door to door, or are they gallerists?
I think it's the toughest sell in the world, because the politicians are extraordinary. You know, we ask them to be extraordinary people. Right? You know, it's incredibly hard jobs we're asking them to do, and then we also ask them to be ordinary people, and then we ask them to navigate that thing in the most artificial settings imaginable, sort of debates on television, staged speeches. So they have to be sort of retail politicians. They have to be every man, but they also have to be these kind of philosopher kings. And, you know, they have to do this all the time. And then once they're in office, they're selling all the time. They have to sell, you know, the most boring things imaginable, you know, tax cuts on, you know, tiny. And then they have to sell the country on the idea of going to war. So I think it's, you know, it's an extraordinary sales challenge. And you know, we also expect them to be kind of morally impeccable, having done all this. And, it, you know, it baffles
and
me.
And sell all these versions of themselves.
Sell all these versions of themselves. So, you know, I think it takes a unique kind of person to want to do that. But I, you know, it's a wonder they don't trip up more and make bigger fools of themselves. So I think, you know, what they're being asked to do is just, you know, nigh on impossible, particularly today.
Well, Philip Tells Branson, thank you very much for coming in and talking about The Art of the Sale, the title of your new book, and of course all the secrets behind it. Thanks a lot for joining us on The Weekly.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And it's time to wrap it up. Aisha Spears on 148th edition of the Monocle Weekly.
We've had some really good music.
Yeah, do you like that?
Yeah, NWA. Who would have thought Shelby Coffee was a big NWA fan?
NWA, X-Ray Specs, and a couple of new things too.
Good. Go. You should be the culture editor.
Yes! I quite enjoyed it. It's good, it's lean, it's mean, it's back in its one-hour form. It's the Monocle Weekly. Who knows who's going to be on it next week? It's like Scrabble. I'm trying to think.
Is it like Scrabble, just making it's up like, our names, pulling out everyone's...
No, it's like putting letters in a bag and then taking them out randomly.
But thankfully, because we're all known by two or three letters at Monocle, it's quite easy. You only need to pick two or three letters. Get TB, AT,
RB. Oh, yeah, you're right. That's exactly how you could do it.
There you go.
And in 2 weeks' time, We're going to be having our 150th anniversary edition or birthday.
Makes it sound very old.
Edition. I don't know what that means. Don't really know what that means. If it was a wedding anniversary, I don't know what it would be. Titanium, possibly.
Oh, super,
plutonium.
Super strength.
I don't neon.
The core of the earth.
The core magma. the magma edition. Sounds like a Lynx type of shower gel. It'll be the 150th edition of the Monocle Weekly, where we'll be having a live music special, and it's going to be 2 hours long, and I think the old crew are going to be back with us. So stay tuned for that. That's in a couple of weeks' time. We're not going to play you out with anything, but what we are going to say is thank you very much to Paul Noble and Tom Hall, who produced today's edition. Thank you for tuning in.